Chapter 28. Like the richly inlet frame of some Renaissance triumph. But the splendid houses with their marble peristyles, and the painted villas in their orange groves along the shore, housed a dull and narrow-minded society, content to amass wealth and play beer by under the eyes of their ancestral Vandyks, without any concern as to the questions agitating the world. A kind of fat commercial dullness, a lack of that personal distinction which justifies magnificence, seemed to Odo the prevailing note of the place, nor was he sorry when his packet set sail for Naples. Here indeed he found all the vivacity that Genoa lacked. Few cities could at first acquaintance be more engaging to the stranger. Dull and brown as it appeared after the rich tints of Genoa, yet so gloriously did sea and land embrace it, so lavishly the sun gilt and the moon silver it, that it seemed steeped in the surrounding hues of nature. And what a nature to eyes subdued to the sober tints of the north! Its spectacular quality, that studied sequence of effects ranging from the translucent outline of Capri, and the fantastically blue mountains of the coast, to Vesuvius lifting its torch above the plain, this prodigal response to fancy's claims suggested the boundless invention of some great scenic artist, some Olympian Veronese with sea and sky for a palette. And then the city itself, huddled between bay and mountains, unseething and bubbling like a Titan's cauldron. Here was life at its source, not checked, directed, utilized, but gushing forth uncontrollably through every fissure of the brown walls, and reeking streets love and hatred, mirth and folly, impudence and greed, going naked and unashamed as the Lazarini on the quays. The variegated surface of it all was fascinating to Odo. It set free his powers of purely physical enjoyment, keeping all deeper sensations in abeyance. These, however, presently found satisfaction in that other hidden beauty, of which city and plain were but the sumptuous drapery. It is hardly too much to say that to the trained eyes of the day the visible Naples hardly existed, so absorbed were they in the perusal of her buried past. The fever of excavation was on every one. No social or political problem could find a hearing, while the subject of the last coin or bas-relief from Pompeii or Herculaneum remained undecided. Odo, at first an amused spectator, gradually found himself engrossed in the fierce quarrels raging over the date of an intaglio, or the myth represented on an amphora. The intrinsic beauty of the objects, and the light they shed on one of the most brilliant phases of human history, were in fact sufficient to justify the prevailing ardor, and the reconstructive habit he had acquired from Crescenti lent a living interest to the driest discussion between rival collectors. Gradually other influences reasserted themselves. At the house of Sir William Hamilton, then the center of the most polished society in Naples, he met not only artists and archaeologists, but men of letters and of affairs. Among these, he was peculiarly drawn to the two distinguished economists, the Abate Galieni and the Cavalier Filangieri, in whose company he enjoyed for the first time sound learning unhampered by pedantry. The lively Galieni proved that social tastes and a broad wit are not incompatible with more serious interests, and Filangieri threw the charm of a graceful personality over any topic he discussed. In the latter, indeed, courtly, young and romantic, a thinker whose intellectual acuteness was steeped in moral emotion, Odo beheld the type of the new chivalry, an ideal leader of the campaign against social injustice. Filangieri represented the extremist optimism of the day. His sense of existing abuses was only equaled by his faith in their speedy amendment. Love was to cure all evils. The love of man for man, the effusive all-embracing sympathy of the school of the Vicaire Savoyard, was to purge the emotions by tenderness and pity. Agamba, the victim of the conditions he denounced, the sense of present hardship prevailed over the faith in future improvement, while Filangieri's social superiority mitigated his view of the evils, and magnified the efficacy of the proposed remedies. Oh, those days passed agreeably in such intercourse, or in the excitement of excursions to the ruined cities, and as the court and the higher society of Naples offered little to engage him, he gradually restricted himself to the small circle of chosen spirits gathered at the Villa Hamilton. To these he fancied the Abate de Crucis might prove an interesting addition, and the desire to learn something of this problematic person induced him to quit the villa at the moment when the Abate took leave. They found themselves together on the threshold, and Odo, recalling to the other the circumstances of their first meeting, proposed that they should dismiss their carriages and regain the city on foot. De Crucis readily consented, and they were soon descending the hill of Posilippo. Here and there a turn in the road brought them to an open space, whence they commanded the bay from Procida to Sorrento, with Capri afloat in liquid gold, and the long blue shadow of Vesuvius stretching like a menace toward the city. The spectacle was one of which Odo never wearied, but today it barely diverted him from the charms of his companion's talk. The Abate de Crucis had that quality of repressed enthusiasm, of an intellectual sensibility tempered by self-possession, which exercises the strongest attraction over a mind not yet master of itself. Though all he said had a personal note, he seemed to withhold himself even in the moment of greatest expansion. Like some prince who should enrich his favorites from the public treasury, but keep his private fortune unimpaired. In the course of their conversation, Odo learned that, though of Austrian birth, his companion was of mingled English and Florentine parentage. A fact perhaps explaining the mixture of urbanity and reserve that lent such charm to his manner. He told Odo that his connection with the Holy Office had been only temporary, and that, having contracted a severe cold the previous winter in Germany, he had accepted a secretaryship in the service of the papal nuncio in order to enjoy the benefits of a mild climate. "Be by profession," he added, "I am a pedagogue, and shall soon travel to Rome, where I have been called by Prince Bracciano to act as governor to his son. And meanwhile I am taking advantage of my residence here to indulge my taste for antiquarian studies." He went on to praise the company they had just left, declaring that he knew no better way for a young man to form his mind than by frequenting the society of men of conflicting views and equal capacity. "And nothing," said he, "is more injurious to the growth of character than to be secluded from argument and opposition. As nothing is healthier than to be obliged to find good reasons for one's beliefs on pain of surrendering them." "But," said Odo, struck with this declaration, "to a man of your cloth there is one belief which never surrenders to reason." The other smiled. "True," he agreed, "but I often marvel to see how little our opponents know of that belief. The wisest of them seem in the case of those children at our country fairs who gape at the incredible things depicted on the curtains of the booths, without asking themselves whether the reality matches its presentment. The weakness of human nature has compelled us to paint the outer curtain of the sanctuary in gaudy colors, and the malicious fancy of our enemies has given a monstrous outline to these pictures. But what are such vanities to one who has passed beyond, and beheld the beauty of the king's daughter, all glorious within?" As though unwilling to linger on such grave topics, he turned the talk to the scene at their feet, questioning Odo as to the impression Naples had made on him. He listened courteously to the young man's comments on the wretched state of the peasantry, the extravagances of the court and nobility, and the judicial corruption which made the lower classes submit to any injustice, rather than seek redress through the courts. De Crucis agreed with him in the main, admitting that the monopoly of corn, the maintenance of feudal rights, and the king's indifference to the graver duties of his rank, placed the kingdom of Naples far below such states as Tuscany or Venetia. "Though," he added, "I think our economists, in praising one state at the expense of another, too often overlook those differences of character and climate that must ever make it impossible to govern different races in the same manner. Our peasants have a blunt saying, 'Cut off the dog's tail, and he is still a dog.' And so I suspect the most enlightened rule would hardly bring this prompt and choleric people, living on a volcanic soil amid a teeming vegetation, into any resemblance with the clear-headed Tuscan, or the gentle and dignified Roman. As he spoke, they emerged upon the Chiaia, where at that hour the quality took the air in their carriages, while the lower classes thronged the footway. A more vivacious scene no city of Europe could present. The gilt coaches drawn by six or eight of the lively Neapolitan horses, decked with plumes and artificial flowers, and preceded by running footmen who beat the foot passengers aside with long staves. The richly dressed ladies seated in this never-ending file of carriages, bejeweled like miraculous images and languidly bowing to their friends. The throngs of citizens and their wives in holiday dress. The sellers of sherbet, ices and pastry bearing their trays and barrels through the crowd with strange cries and the jingling of bells. The friars of every order in their various habits. The street musicians. The half-naked lazzaroni. Cripples and beggars, who fringed the throng like the line of scum edging a fair lake. This medley of sound and color, which in fact resembled some sudden growth of the fiery soil, was an expressive comment on the abate's words. "Look," he continued, as he and Dodo drew aside, to escape the mud from an emblazoned chariot, at the gold leaf on the panels of that coach, and the gold lace on the liveries of those lackeys. Is there any other city in the world where gold is so prodigally used? Where the monks gild their relics, the nobility their servants, the apothecaries their pills, the very butchers their mutton? One might fancy their bright sun had set them the example. And how cold and gray all soberer tints must seem to these children of Apollo. Well, so it is with their religion and their daily life. I wager half those naked wretches yonder would rather attend a fine religious service, with abundance of gilt candles, music from gilt organ pipes, and incense from gilt censers, than eat a good meal or sleep in a decent bed, as they would rather starve under a handsome merry king, that has the name of being the best billiard player in Europe, than go full under one of your solemn reforming Austrian archdukes. The words recalled to Odo Crescenti's theory of the influence of character and climate on the course of history, and this subject soon engrossing both speakers, they wandered on, inattentive to their surroundings, till they found themselves in the thickest concourse of the Toledo. Here for a moment the dense crowd hemmed them in, and as they stood observing the humors of the scene, Odo's eye fell on the thick-set figure of a man in doctor's dress, who was being led through the press by two agents of the Inquisition. The sight was too common to have fixed his attention, had he not recognized with a start the irascible red-faced professor who, on his first visit to Vivaldi, had defended the diluvial theory of creation. The sight raised a host of memories from which Odo would gladly have beaten a retreat. But the crowd held him in check, and a moment later he saw that the doctor's eyes were fixed on him with an air of recognition. A movement of pity succeeded his first impulse, and turning to De Crucis he exclaimed, "See yonder an old acquaintance who seems in an unlucky plight, and with whom I should be glad to speak." The other, following his glance, beckoned to one of the spurry, who made his way through the throng with the alacrity of one summoned by a superior. De Crucis exchanged a few words with him, and then signed to him to return to his charge, who presently vanished in some fresh shifting of the crowd. "Your friend," said De Crucis, "has been summoned before the Holy Office, to answer a charge of heresy preferred by the authorities. He has lately been appointed to the chair of physical sciences in the university here, and has doubtless allowed himself to publish openly views that were better expounded in the closet. His offense, however, appears to be a mild one, and I make no doubt he will be set free in a few days." This, however, did not satisfy Odo, and he asked De Crucis if there were no way of speaking with the doctor at once. His companion hesitated. "It can easily be arranged," said he, "but pardon me, Cavalier, are you well advised in mixing yourself in such matters?" "I am well advised in seeking to serve a friend," Odo somewhat oddly returned. And the Crucis, with a faint smile of approval, replied quietly, "Colon, in that case I will obtain permission for you to visit your friend in the morning." He was true to his word, and the next forenoon Odo, accompanied by an officer of police, was taken to the prison of the Inquisition. Here he found his old acquaintance seated in a clean, commodious room, and reading Aristotle's History of Animals, the only volume of his library that he had been permitted to carry with him. He welcomed Odo heartily, and on the latter's inquiring what had brought him to this plight, replied with some dignity that he had been led there in the fulfillment of his duty. "Some months ago," he continued, "I was summoned hither to profess the natural sciences in the university, a summons I readily accepted, since I hoped, by the study of a volcanic soil, to enlarge my knowledge of the globe's formation. Such in fact was the case, but to my surprise my researches led me to adopt the views I had formerly combated, and I now find myself in the ranks of the volcanists, or believers in the secondary origin of the earth. A view you may remember I once opposed with all the zeal of inexperience. Having firmly established every point in my argument according to the Baconian method of investigation, I felt it my duty to enlighten my scholars, and in the course of my last lecture I announced the result of my investigations. I was of course aware of the inevitable result, but the servants of truth have no choice but to follow where she calls, and many have joyfully traversed stonier places than I am likely to travel." Nothing could exceed the respect with which Odo heard this simple confession of faith. It was as though the speaker had unconsciously convicted him of remissness, of cowardice even, so vain and windy his theorizing seemed, judged by the other's deliberate act. Yet placed as he was, what could he do, how advance their common end, but by passively waiting on events? At least, he reflected, he could perform the trivial service of trying to better his friend's case, and this he eagerly offered to attempt. The doctor thanked him, but without any great appearance of emotion. Odo was struck by the change which had transformed a heady and intemperate speaker into a model of philosophic calm. The doctor, indeed, seemed far more concerned for the safety of his library and his cabinet of minerals than for his own. "Happily," said he, "I am not a man of family, and can therefore sacrifice my liberty with a clear conscience. A fact I am the more thankful for, when I recall the moral distress of our poor friend Vivaldi, when compelled to desert his post, rather than be separated from his daughter." The name brought the color to Odo's brow, and with an embarrassed air he asked what news the doctor had of their friend. "Alas," said the other, "the last was of his death, which happened 2 years since in Pavia. The Sardinian government had, as you probably know, confiscated his small property on his leaving the state, and I am told he died in great poverty, and in sore anxiety for his daughter's future." He added that these events had taken place before his own departure from Turin, and that since then he had learned nothing of Fulvia's fate, save that she was said to have made her home with an aunt who lived in a town of the Veneto. Odo listened in silence. The lapse of time, and the absence of any links of association, had dimmed the girl's image in his breast, but at the mere sound of her name it lived again, and he felt her interwoven with his deepest fibers. The picture of her father's death, and of her own need filled him with an ineffectual pity, and for a moment he thought of seeking her out, but the other could recall neither the name of the towness he had removed to, nor that of the relative who had given her a home. To aid the good doctor was a simpler business. The intervention of the Crucis and Odo's own influence sufficed to effect his release, and on the payment of a heavy fine in which Odo privately assisted him, he was reinstated in his chair. The only promise exacted by the Holy Office was that he should in future avoid propounding his own views on questions already decided by Scripture, and to this he readily agreed, since, as he shrewdly remarked to Odo, his opinions were now well known, and any who wished farther instruction had only to apply to him privately. the old duke having invited Odo to return to Monte Loro with such treasures as he had collected for the ducal galleries, the young man resolved to visit Rome on his way to the north. His acquaintance with the Crucis had grown into something like friendship since their joint effort in behalf of the imprisoned sage, and the abate preparing to set out about the same time, the two agreed to travel together. The road leading from Naples to Rome was at that time one of the worst in Italy, and was besides so ill provided with inns that there was no inducement to linger on the way. The Crucis, however, succeeded in enlivening even this tedious journey. He was a good linguist and a sound classical scholar, besides having, as he had told Odo, a pronounced taste for antiquarian research. In addition to this, he performed agreeably on the violin, and was well acquainted with the history of music. His chief distinction, however, lay in the ease with which he wore his accomplishments, and in the breadth of view that made it possible to discuss with him many subjects distasteful to most men of his cloth. The Skeptical Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.